Broadcasting from the gulag city of planet Earth, this is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. I'm Dean Becker. Our engineer is Steve Nolan. Tammy and the crew are here to answer the phones and man the computers. Our guest for the evening is the president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation in Washington, D.C., Eric Sterling. We'll give you a chance to call in and ask him a few questions a bit later to discuss the tragedy of this 88-year-old drug war. We'll have the news in just a bit, but we start today with a poem, Come to the Edge, by the French, Italian, Polish poet Guillaume Apollinaire. Come to the edge, he said. They said, we are afraid. Come to the edge, he said. They came. He pushed them, and they flew. And now the drug war news. I keep talking about the critical mass, the number of scientists, doctors, politicians, cops, and whatever that will be necessary to end the drug war. How many people must speak up? Well, here comes a story that cries not from the wilderness, but from the airwaves of the British Broadcasting Corporation. A retired surgeon from Cornwall is calling for the legalization of cannabis and ecstasy. Connie Fossard, 70 years old, who is currently the mayor of Truro, said in addressing the recent British Medical Association conference, quote, recreational drugs should be legalized, quality controlled, and sold over the county. She also said there needs to be a public debate aimed at reducing drug-related crime. The motion from the British Medical Association's Cornwall branch specifically refers to cannabinoid drugs, but Ms. Fossard said that ecstasy could be brought into the discussion. She maintained that the move would help reduce violent crime committed by users to pay for drugs. Quote, it is something which should be raised for the public to have a say in, end quote. And I say, hear, hear. That is the whole point of this Cultural Baggage radio show, to discuss this openly. She was asked if legalization would tempt more people to sample drugs, and she said, is it not the same with alcohol? What is the difference, end quote. Controlled quantities of purified drugs could be sold in licensed premises and could be taxed just like alcohol. Ms. Fossard continued, the government should be treating people as adults and not treating adults as children in their own homes. This story from Washington, D.C., from Reuters. The United States said on Tuesday it was cutting off military aid to 35 countries, including Colombia and six nations seeking NATO membership because they back the International Criminal Court and have not exempted Americans from possible prosecution. The decision to suspend aid is the latest attack by the Bush administration on the International Court set up last year to try war crimes and acts of genocide. But the Bush administration is afraid the tribunal in The Hague, in the Netherlands, backed by most European countries, might hear politically motivated prosecutions of U.S. military and civilian leaders. The suspension of aid worked against some of the Bush administration's other policy goals, such as intercepting drugs in the Caribbean and expanding NATO into Eastern Europe. In closing the news segment, I recommend that you tune in each afternoon right here on KPFT at 4:20 p.m. for the drug war news. But to end the drug war, we must get to the heart of the matter. We must look at the cash flow. We must ask who makes the most from drug prohibition. And I can only say that besides the millions who profit from the current drug war, examples, cops, politicians, urine testers, prison builders, doctors, lawyers, judges, there are two groups who make the lion's share, billions and billions every year. And those are drug cartels and the U.S. banks who launder the money for the cartels. In fact, the banks sometimes charge up to 80% of the take for their laundering efforts. So in essence, the ones who profit most, the grand kahunas of the drug war, are working at the Chase Manhattan Bank. For additional drug war news, please keep tuned right here to KPFT Houston.
Hundreds and hundreds of teenage boys and girls are becoming hopeless dope addicts.
Marijuana may not cause overdose deaths, but it's just as dangerous.
Over 70% of all crime is drug-related.
And we now see more and more organized crime supporting terror.
If you quit drugs, you join the fight against terror in America. The Drug War News, each afternoon at 4:20, every Thursday night at 11 p.m., the unvarnished truth.
Well, I really liked my promo so much I wanted to play for you, but the fact is we're moving to Tuesday nights, 6:30 to 7 p.m. We'll be right there between Counterspin and Flashpoints. Hope to see you there. That's Tuesday night, 6:30 to 7 p.m. Okay, without any further ado, we're going to go ahead and bring on our guest for the evening. A gentleman has written a book, Drug Policy, working title, A Challenge of Values, and a man who has much experience with the drug war. I'm proud to welcome Eric Sterling.
Good evening, Dean.
Hello, Eric. How are you, sir?
Good.
Yes, sir. Welcome to Cultural Baggage. I hope you were able to hear some of my intro. And I was just wondering if you would, I guess, first off, tell the folks who you are and what you're trying to do about this drug war.
Since 1989, I've been working trying to end the drug war, to try to establish a system of regulation and control of the distribution and use of the now illegal drugs. In the 1980s, I was counsel to the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on the Judiciary. My job was to oversee the federal drug agencies and to write federal drug laws. I was majority counsel, so I worked for the Democrats who controlled the House of Representatives, and the members of the committee were my clients in the development of those laws.
Well, I understand that. I guess I want to ask you, was there some date of conversion where Saul turns to Paul? How did you get into drug reform, Eric?
I've been involved in drug reform actually since 1976 when I was in law school. I testified for marijuana decriminalization that spring before the Pennsylvania legislature. I was hired by the Judiciary Committee to assist it, and the members of Congress were my clients. When I was a criminal trial lawyer and I represented people accused of burglary, I was not a fan of burglary. I was not an advocate for burglary. I was representing my clients to give them the best legal help that I could. Similarly, in representing members of Congress, I was doing the best job that I could to help them write the best laws. I was not elected by the American people to make the laws. That's what the members of Congress were elected to do. But while I worked for the committee, I held some of the views that I held now. I held then, and I always should say is that I increasingly recognize that prohibition didn't make sense. I had a strong sense that it didn't make sense in the case of marijuana when I started working on Capitol Hill, but increasingly I saw for drugs such as heroin and cocaine that it wasn't working either. And I had a stronger sense then that those drugs need to be regulated and controlled rather than prohibited.
I understand. Probably just my misconception. I thought that, well, never mind. Obviously, you do the job that the client presents, and that's what we all must do these days. I'm looking at a little quote from the treatment on your book you're doing, and I'd like to read this if I could. It struck me as odd, and I think this is quite telling. It says, quote, "If behavior were to become less deviant, then society would respond by redefining previously minor infractions as crime and punishing these." And that's kind of what we're doing, isn't it?
Yeah, this is not a thought original with me. This is an idea that goes back to one of the great sociologists, Emil Durkheim, and what I've written is a chapter in a book. I've not written the whole book. I've simply contributed a chapter to a book that will be called Criminal Justice Retribution versus Restoration, which is coming out from the Hayworth Press next spring. I've written a chapter on drug policy, and the chapter then sort of takes off from the fact that the there's been a dramatic change in incarceration in America beginning in about 1970. For many years, I've heard Al Blumstein, one of America's most respected criminologists, present data about the criminal justice system, and he would put up a chart that would show from 1930 to 1970 that the rate of incarceration in America was level from 1930 at the height of alcohol prohibition until 1970. It's sort of for this 40-year period through the Depression, through World War II, through the post-war economic boom, through the 50s, through the 60s, and all the turbulence of the 60s, the rate of incarceration remained the same at about 110 per 100,000. And then he moves a piece of paper, and you see on the chart how the rate of incarceration suddenly pivots in 1970 and goes up steadily, where it's now about 700 per 100,000. And I remember saying, what happened in 1970? Why is this the moment? What, you know, why historically? And when you think about how the war on drugs is focused in its effect upon people of color, and you then recognize that 1970 is really the point at which the civil rights movement completes its work. You had the struggle to end segregation in schools. You had Brown versus Board of Education in the mid-50s. You have the Civil Rights Acts of the 1960s. You have the court opinions that finally end segregation in housing and transportation and education and public accommodations and employment and so forth. That pretty much all falls into place by 1970. And what I came to sort of recognize is that if you think about the racial segregation, it was a historic fact. It's hard for us now, you know, in the year 2003 to sort of remember what segregation was like. But for the first 70 years of this century, for people of color, it meant that they were continually being subjected to a second-class status wherever they were and whatever they did. And this was a form of punishment that was as oppressive as being on probation is today, or being on parole, controlling where you can go and what you can do and with whom you can associate. Exactly like probation and parole, a form of punishment. And that when that form of punishment got eliminated by the end of segregation in a lawful sense, the power in American society to maintain white privilege, a power that has been a dominant force in American society since the early 17th century, that didn't evaporate. That force found a new expression in various cultural ways, and that way primarily, I argue, in a legal sense, has been through the war on drugs. That what we find is, you know, before 1970, you know, white teenagers were arrested for drug offenses much more frequently than black teenagers. Now that's completely turned around, even though the government's data shows that white teenagers use drugs like marijuana at 2, 3, and 4 times the rate that black teenagers do. And they use cocaine at much higher rates, and they use heroin at much higher rates. And people say, well, what are you talking about? How can that possibly be true? Because the cultural message of part of the war on drugs is blacks use drugs. They can't be trusted because they're drug users. This is so ingrained in the culture that a couple of months ago, there was a debate in the House of Representatives on a bill dealing with the sale of firearms, and the liability of firearms manufacturers for the crimes committed by people using their products. Congress was debating a bill to say that there could not be lawsuits brought against firearms manufacturers. And there was an amendment that was offered that said if guns are sold to drug dealers and used in a crime, that you, and this was done with the knowledge or the negligence of the seller, that there would be liability. And Congresswoman Barbara Coogan from Wyoming rose to the floor to say, well, you know, if the gentleman's amendment becomes the law, no one could go into the black community and sell drugs. Could sell guns. You couldn't sell a gun to a black person.
Yeah.
And in effect, trying to create, sort of repeating this kind of cultural myth, well, if they're black, they must be using drugs. That is part of what the power of the war on drugs has been, to maintain this that myth, and by its legal consequences in terms of imprisonment, in terms of the prohibition on getting college loans if you have a drug conviction, the prohibition of being in public housing if you have a drug conviction, the prohibition on having welfare benefits if you have a drug conviction. These are the ways in which the resegregation power, the maintenance of white privilege, carries forward in the society.
Well, Eric, earlier this week we talked, and you quoted me some numbers, and one that I think I picked up out of the New York Times. One in three black males between the ages of 18 and 35 are currently involved with the criminal justice system. One out of three.
That is a sort of a, I've seen it as high as one out of four. It could be that high.
Well, maybe I'm talking about Houston. I did see it.
Yeah. Well, this would be people who are awaiting trial, who are on bail, who are on probation, on parole, in jail. So it's both the accused and the convicted. And it reflects the way in which law enforcement dragnets take place, and it reflects the what I would argue is the corruption of the criminal justice system. The case in Tulia, Texas, that I'm sure your listeners are quite familiar with.
You bet.
Where perjured testimony, unverified, uncorroborated perjured testimony becomes the basis for arrest warrants for 46 people, and the basis for convictions and sentences as long as 90 years for people who are people of color. Approximately 38% of all of those who are arrested for drug offenses in America are black, but 58% of those who are convicted are black. You have to ask just what happens inside the courthouse, where essentially one out of three coming in the front door are black, but two out of three going out the back door with a conviction are black. And I would argue that it is because of the continuing force of racism in American society, and particularly in the criminal justice system, that continues to be the case.
It's certainly the numbers are reflected in here in the Texas prison population. I think of, you mentioned Tulia, and the outrageousness of it. One of the gentlemen who was released just 2 weeks past got himself into some sort of episode, shall we say. They said he wasn't necessarily drunk or stoned, just had an episode. They wound up saying he assaulted a police officer, and they put a $3 million bond on this young man.
That kind of bail, is outrageous. The Constitution, the Eighth Amendment forbids excessive bail. Bail is supposed to assure that someone turns up. This is a man probably whose entire family lives in Tulia. And it is not hard to imagine someone who has been in jail for 3 years, felt wrongly convicted and aggrieved from the first place, getting out and celebrating and getting drunk. I mean, think of how many people get drunk on, you know, just because, you know, they're...
It's Friday.
It's Friday, or it's their birthday, or it's the 4th of July.
Sure. No, it just seems so wrong. The guy perhaps needs a little mental counsel, psychiatric counseling or something, and they slapped $3 million bail on him.
The Birmingham, Alabama News has a front page story today, in fact, about the release of people from the prisons there because of the overcrowding and the expense. And they're releasing, they're releasing people. A woman was being released. She said, you know, I've been in prison for 8 years. I don't know how to balance a checkbook. I'm scared to death. I'm not ready. I have, I don't have contact with my family. They're going to let me go. They're going to give me $10 and a bus ticket. And they're going to give me a 10-day supply of the psychiatric medication that I take for bipolar disorder, and that's it.
Mm.
And I'm going, and essentially they're sending me to the streets.
To fall off the medical regimen and suffer the consequence.
There is a utter failure to sort of recognize what we need to be doing. When people ask me, well, Eric, what do you think we ought to be doing about the war on drugs? I say, the first thing we need is universal health care. Because so many of the people who are using illegal drugs are doing so because they have mental illness that's never been treated. That, there are tens of millions of people who don't have access to health care and to mental health care. They suffer from major depressive illness, bipolar disease, psychosis, remaining untreated. Well, the various kinds of drugs, such as the depressants, heroin, and opiates, suppress that. People who feel terribly depressed, well, stimulants like cocaine and amphetamines make them feel better. These are not folks who can go get a doctor's prescription because they don't have a doctor. They can't spend hundreds of dollars buying pharmaceutical medications, but they can spend, find $10 or $20 and get a hit of this or a hit of that. And these drugs, with all of their side effects, do have these powerful effects that people get and want. So that I think that there are things that we need to do that have nothing to do with the criminal justice system, nothing to do with drug policy, that are the kinds of things that are important if we're interested in addressing the drug problem in our society.
Indeed, Eric. I have a clip here. It's really more about sacramental use, the right to free choice, etc. And this is from... Nadine Strasser of the ACLU, and let's hear that, Steve.
The war on drugs has warped judicial neutrality and constitutional law. The judge made drug exceptions to every precious constitutional right, including rights that would seem to have very little to do with drugs, such as the First Amendment's guarantee of religious liberty. So religious freedom remains one of the many constitutional rights that have become casualties of the war on drugs.
To me, Eric, I mean, I have a church. I'm not asking you to delve into this too deeply, but, it's called the Church of God's Evident Truth. We believe that marijuana is a sacrament, and I have about 900 members. And it does feel like persecution sometimes when some of my members get hauled off to jail. We had an instance here where at a marijuana rally, we had 23 cops bust a total of 8 kids for a total of 1.3 grams of marijuana. And, it's just such a waste of time in this war of terror, if you want to call it that, to be sending that many police officers to do so very little.
I've written a chapter that's been published in a book called Entheogens and the Future of Religion. Entheogens, E-N-T-H-E-O-G-E-N-S, and the Future of Religion, that's edited by Robert Fort, F-O-R-T-E, and published by the Council on Spiritual Practices. Entheogens are compounds that help release the God within, or to stimulate the God within. And the term is applied to very old compounds like peyote, which includes what the dominant society calls mescaline. Peyote has been used for as a religious sacrament since the year 600 by the Huichol people in Mexico, and since the 19th century has been used by Native American people in the United States. The Native American church in North America was incorporated about 1917, and peyote has been its sacrament. It's used now probably by about 250,000 Native Americans. And because the dominant society had classified mescaline and peyote as a drug, Indians were being prosecuted for their use of peyote in their worship. Now, there is no peyote drug abuse problem. There's no peyote drive-by shootings in Houston or in Chicago. There are no kids hanging out, you know, getting high on peyote, you know, in high school or whatever. It's not a drug abuse problem like many of the other refined drugs. But it was lumped together, and Indians were being persecuted. And in 1990, I helped organize in my office the Native American Religious Freedom Project. We had a protest on the grounds of the what is now the Smithsonian's National Museum of the Native Americans. It's being completed on the Mall. We organized under the supervision of the U.S. National Park Service, three sacred fireplaces were held in Greenbelt Park just outside the nation's capital so that congressional staff, religious leaders, journalists, and others could experience what Native American worship was, you know, and sort of how they could understand that this is not just like a hippie LSD trip or a Grateful Dead show or something like that. What you are describing is something that I think is critically important, is that there's such a tremendous difference between a drug like heroin and a drug like cocaine, and the mind, the psychedelic drugs, the entheogen drugs. There is, I know many people who use cannabis spiritually, and it has been used spiritually for hundreds of years in Jamaica and other places. There are my organization, the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, helped finance the defense of Brother Michael Madison of the Ethiopian Zion Coptic Church in his prosecution in Wisconsin, helping to fly in expert witnesses to testify on his behalf. So what you're describing is something that I completely affirm, that cannabis can have used in the proper setting, in the proper way, a very useful spiritual component. That doesn't mean that all people see it that way. We, in the Christian tradition, many people, are aware of the sacramental power of wine as the blood of Christ, and yet there are other people who get drunk on wine and have terrible problems with it. And that we are able to draw these distinctions in the case of wine, and we're going to, as a society, have to learn how to draw these distinctions because, as you point out, these are invasions of our most sacred liberties. And it is worth reflecting as we celebrate tomorrow the Declaration of Independence and the affirmation of the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that the invasion of our religious liberty in the name of the war on drugs is one of the most heinous components of that failed social policy.
Thank you, Eric. We're going to take a little break here. I want to make a couple of comments here. First, I want to thank all the donors who pledged the cultural baggage in 420. We went way over our goal, and I want to thank you so much for taking the time to phone in your pledges. Now, we're no longer going to be on Friday at midnight. You'll be able to tune in every week and hear Glenn Urbach. We'll be on Tuesdays, 6:30 to 7. We'll be right back.
Homer, you're doing drugs. And now I'm guilty of possession. I could go to prison. Unless I testify against you.
Marge, it's making my eyes better. And it's legal. I could walk up to the president and blow smoke in his stupid monkey face. And he'd just have to sit there grooving on it.
Okay, maybe a little of the money I spend on marijuana winds up in the bad guy's hands.
Correct.
And that's because marijuana is illegal.
Exactly.
When I buy beer, that doesn't support terror because it's legal, right?
Now you got it.
So you're saying if we make marijuana legal and regulate it like beer, it wouldn't support violence?
Did I say that?
Marijuana prohibition. Harmless? Contact Houston Normal. Houston, NORML.org.
No more time.
This is Mark Greer, Executive Director of Drug Sense. You're listening to Cultural Baggage on 90.1 KPFT in Houston. To end the drug war, visit MAPINC.org. That's MAPINC.org. Get active, stay aware, stay informed, and let's bring an end to this nonsense.
Okay. I want to get to the callers here in just a minute, and once again, we have a few more lines open. Our number, 713-526-5738. Eric, let's just go ahead and we'll take the first call here. It looks like, who was on first? Scooter, calling from Houston. Are you there, Scooter?
Hey, how's it going?
Well, doing good, Scooter. How are you tonight?
Hey, well, it's good to hear you on the air, and it's really good to hear Eric Sterling on the air. Back in the day, we used to put Eric on the air, it was 5 or 6 years ago, and he did this great speech that talked about how the drug war violated all of every single one of the first 10 amendments, and we sold that we put that out as a premium and made a ton of money on it. So hi, Eric, it's great to hear you, and see you later.
Scooter, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
The I remember those days. The speech was I gave it a speech to the Colorado Bar Association in 1990. And it's called The Bill of Rights, A Casualty of the War on Drugs. The text is available on my website, www.cjpf.org. Or you could find it by going to Google. It's on many different websites by now. And I've always been delighted that KPFT used that speech to raise funds for this outstanding radio station and Voice of Freedom. In Houston, Texas.
Thank you, Eric. Scooter's did drop off the line there. I'm sure he's listening over the air. Thank you, Scooter. Eric, it seems to me, I mean, I'm always asking, what is the critical mass? Every day there's more scientists, doctors, lawyers, etc., saying this drug war is crazy, there is a better way, and yet the politicians feign ignorance and pretend not to notice the facts. I'm just amazed that they get away with it for so long.
Well, you know, the question you're asking is one that many of us have asked for a very, very long time. I don't know what the tipping point will be. Part of it is feigning ignorance, and, you know, there is, I think, a myth for a long time, you know, many people said, oh, well, you couldn't talk about drug legalization because that would be political suicide. And I don't think that that's it. I don't think that there are so many people who would vote against an incumbent who took a reform position on drugs. I think that what it is that they are really afraid of being made a joke, of being mocked. Politicians take themselves extremely seriously. When Governor Gary Johnson of New Mexico began speaking against the war on drugs, the answer of the then drug czar Barry McCaffrey was to use ridicule, to call him Puff Daddy, to suggest that he had lost his marbles or that he was smoking something, that he wasn't quite that he was well-meaning but kind of stupid or touched.
Right.
Here in Maryland, where I live and work, a very courageous member of our General Assembly House of Delegates, Don Murphy, a very conservative Republican from Baltimore County, introduced a medical marijuana bill. And all of the people in the cloakroom would make jokes every time he came up, hey, Don, what parties have you been to? Hey, you got any good weed? And it was, in other words, he no longer was taken seriously. Now, even though he didn't back down, every year he came back with more co-sponsors on his bill, and the bill finally passed, and the governor, the Republican governor here, Bob Ehrlich, signed the medical marijuana bill a couple of months ago. But it takes the willingness to say, I don't care what you say. I don't care what you in the cloakroom think about me. I'm right. And, of course, Murphy was really ultimately admired for his courage.
Yes, sir. I agree. It does take just daring to fade the heat. We're going to go to our next caller. It's Robert calling from Ohio. Hello, Robert. Robert.
Can you hear me well?
I hear you now, sir. Yes, sir. Good. Welcome to Cultural Baggage. Did you have a question for Mr. Sterling?
Yes, I actually had a question for him, but I'd like to actually follow up on what he was just talking about. How you doing, Eric?
Hi, Robert.
How's it going?
You guys must be friends. That's Robert Ryan. It says out of Ohio, formerly Maryland, I guess.
Yeah, I was a member of the Republican Central Committee at the time. I'm now in Ohio. So there was a lot of work going on to make that bill happen at many different levels and many different people.
And Robert was a very, very strong ally of ours in Maryland. He's now doing a terrific job with the Ohio Patients Network.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Eric. But anyway, where were we going? We were talking about Don Murphy. Just to give you a little tidbit, people do suffer from this, and it's the politicians that suffer. There was, I think, three delegates who lost their elections due to this issue. They were not back in the assembly the next year.
For advocating the decrim or something?
The opposite.
No, for their harsh stance.
Oh, well, wonderful. I'm glad to hear that.
And this is the time, and this is the opportunities we have in front of us. There are a number of bills through the country and national. One of them is the, the FAR Act?
Right, H.R. 1717.
Right.
Truth in Trials Act.
Truth in Trials. There is not a politician around who will enjoy looking at this room full of people in the basement of a church when he's asked the question, do you believe people should have the right to defend themselves in court when it concerns marijuana? And if he says, no, they shouldn't have the right to defend themselves, could you imagine what those people's faces will look like? And that's the kind of pressure we need to put on at all these little events and churches and, all the various town meetings that are going to happen, get out there and put these people on the spot.
You bet.
Because Robert is absolutely right. If there's anything that your listeners could, if there's one thing they could do, it is to attend the town hall meetings of their members of Congress and their other elected officials and to stand up and question them to their face about these issues. I was recently at a town hall meeting of my congressman, a freshman Democrat here in Montgomery County, Maryland, and the thing ran 40 minutes late. I asked the last question, and it was about medical marijuana, trying to put him on the spot. Why hasn't he taken this position? Why hasn't he co-sponsored Sam Farr's bill? And he said, well, I'll have to look at it. I need to know more about it. And it became an invitation, to begin a more in-depth dialogue with him because he's now said he wants to know more about it. Well, we'll make sure he does. And we have been, sending him information.
Robert, we do have some other callers. I appreciate you calling. Please call us again at a future time. We thank you, sir.
Nice
okay. Talking. We do have a question. This is anonymous. Came from the Drug Sense chat line. That's drugsense.org. Y'all can join in if you want. And ask Eric, could you talk a little more about how the HEA drug provision serves to further the disempowering of African Americans?
The which drug provision?
HEA.
HEA.
Yes.
HEA refers to the Higher Education Act of 1998, and a provision added to that without any hearings said that if you have ever been convicted of a drug offense, you are, if it's a possession offense, you're barred from any federal financial assistance to your college for college education purposes for a year. If it's a trafficking offense, it's 2 years unless you get treatment. Now, if you're a wealthy person, you're not applying for college loans. If you're wealthy enough, you don't qualify. This is not an issue. It is primarily poor people, of course, who need these loans to get their college education. Well, the other thing to sort of recognize is that through the practice of racial profiling, in which black people are stopped on the street, they're stopped when driving, they're stopped when coming into the country at the airport, and searched at rates that are disproportionate, that is, at higher rates than would be warranted if the searching were simply random, results in more frequent busts of them. Now, what's particularly flawed about this is that the hit rate is much higher for whites than it is for blacks. Professor David Harris at the University of Toledo Law School, in his book on racial profiling, pointed out that wherever it has been studied, when cops stop whites, a higher percentage of the whites are carrying drugs than the percentage of blacks who are stopped. So if the purpose of this, of the practice, is to catch drug traffickers, they should be focusing on the whites. But since the purpose is not to catch drug traffickers, but I think is actually to reinforce the historic second-class status that people of color have in our society, that's why they're stopped. And the consequence then for African-Americans who have drug convictions is that they're unable to get into college, and therefore the kind of segregation that existed historically in higher education for much of the 20th century gets reinvigorated.
Thank you, Eric. We're going to go to Tom on line 3. We do have some open lines again. 713-526-5738. Hello, Tom.
Hi there. I want to throw out some wisdom. First of all, we live in one of the silliest societies I think the earth has ever seen. Americans do everything to extreme, whether it's ingest drugs or enforce drug laws. I mean, everything's an extreme in America. Is that right?
Eric?
I don't know that I would endorse that. You know, I think I'm not sure that we are, that we have a higher rate of drug use than other societies. We have more money as a society at large, and therefore we can certainly afford to consume more drugs. But I don't know if on a per capita basis, certainly there are other countries that are higher per capita consumers of alcoholic beverages than we are. I think Germany is one. I suspect Ireland and Australia are others.
France is too. France with the wine. But I mean, we got people, you know, in this country that consume 2-3 packs of cigarettes a day, 10-12 joints a day. Americans do everything to extreme, and that is also ingest sugar, junk food, getting fatter. I mean, Americans are the fattest people, you know, on the planet. You go to Europe, you don't see them that fat. And I don't believe that. What was one of your statements? Oh, doggone, I can't remember now. I disagree with you on something. Anyway, America does everything to extreme. You know, in every way, it's everything's always extreme. Oh, also, I think you got a real hard sell to the average conservative person who doesn't do drugs and who doesn't even smoke, marijuana, just legalize marijuana and everything will be okay.
Yeah, well, that is not my position, Tom. I'm glad you raised that. To adopt a program of regulation and control of the controlled substances, which are, of course, now out of control, is not going to make everything okay. It's not going to end the drug problem.
Yeah.
It's going to reduce some of the more serious aspects of the drug problem, but there is no magic solution.
To the average voter, it looks like you're going to open the floodgates, and then soon after, LSD is going to be okay to legalize, and cocaine and crack and everything else. And they're totally afraid of it because they don't do drugs. Oh, I remember what I disagreed with. You said people have mental illness and the drugs make them feel better. I disagree with that. Drugs are fun. And to human beings, it's fun to do anything bad. Whatever's bad is fun to do.
Oh, Tom, of course, you know, most American drug users do not have mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most American drug users are working people, sane people, family people. Most American drug users are indistinguishable from their neighbors. But in talking about the people who have the worst drug problems, the people who are most hurt by drugs, people who have the most trouble controlling their drug use, those are often people who suffer from mental illness.
I don't think so. I mean, same with gambling. People just get hooked on gambling. They have addictions, and something feeds it. You know, they figure out something that makes them feel better. And, oh, that even includes sniffing glue. I never in a million years would have thought of sniffing glue. I never did it anyway, but when I hear about it, I can't hardly believe it. You know, we got lots of people that sniff glue at, you know, 11, 12, 13.
We have Alaskan children that sniff gasoline because they can't afford the high-priced marijuana up there and bored to death.
But that's the way Americans are. They're nuts. And they're ready for addictions, it seems like, and they do everything to extreme.
Well,
drugs, sugar, whatever.
Tom, we thank
yes,
you
sir.
For your call. We're going to get to another couple of calls here.
I like your show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. I wanted to just make one point.
Go ahead.
This weekend, on Sunday, the 6th of July, marks the 30th anniversary of the creation of the Drug Enforcement Administration by executive order by President Nixon on July 6, 1973. And it is worth noting that in the 30 years of the Drug Enforcement Administration, what an utter failure it has been. The organization has grown from a budget of about $100 million to $1.6 billion. Its agent forces more than doubled. And yet, during that time, the availability of marijuana to high school kids has hardly changed at all, according to our annual survey of availability. In that time, the price of cocaine and heroin on a dollar per pure gram basis has gone down steadily. In that time, the purity of cocaine and heroin, the average purity when purchased at retail, has gone up. In fact, between 1980 and the most recent data, purity of heroin on average went from 5% to 25%. This is all a function of the work that DEA has done, and in some sense, illegal drugs are like the computer industry, in which prices have gone down and performance has gone up year after year. And it is worth asking, after 30 years and billions of dollars spent, if this agency shouldn't be abolished as an utter failure and waste of the taxpayers' money.
Absolutely right. I agree wholeheartedly, Eric. We have, I guess, time for one more caller. Let's go ahead and pick up Randall. Hello, Randall.
Hello, yes. This is one of the banes that I see that have been poisoning the so-called Great Experiment ever since the government found out that they could simply make something illegal and ignore the Bill of Rights or the Constitution. Because I don't recall which amendment it is that made all drugs that they decide upon illegal that way.
There was no amendment.
Well, of course not. And I don't hear any historians or lawyers or anyone who supposedly know the Constitution or Bill of Rights, and especially the Ninth Amendment, the one that so many of them in jurisprudence can't seem to see, which says that essentially that any rights not enumerated still exist, because the idea of the Bill of Rights was anti-federalist. But then, since they don't seem to be teaching much in the way of real history these days, except perhaps in colleges or universities, but what we need is true education, what I call drug-wise, for a little phrase, since we have this selective drug war to make certain groups illegal, certainly against the fine capitalist idea of what people want and to purchase it. You know, the invisible hand has been turned into the quite visible claw. And what it needs is to be stopped. One of the first things is that we need really a massive propaganda effort to try to counter the propaganda effort that's been going on at least since 1914, if not before. I mean, in the 1890s, that was when they started to demonize cocaine, even. And it was certainly not used in the kind of refined quantities it's used now. I mean, dosage counts for some of these drugs, and just because somebody used them poorly doesn't mean they should go to those terrible places called prisons. I mean, more people's lives have been destroyed by being sent to prison than any drug overdose or damage,
Eric.
Truthfully. And yet there it is out there, and what it's done is that it's fueled the police state mentality, the paramilitary increase, which is even accelerated more now under our so-called president. And we get John Ashcroft acting like Heinrich Himmler, even during the midst of the war on terrorism, going to California and attacking people who are using marijuana for medicinal uses.
Randall, I hate to interrupt you. You're on a great roll. No, I mean, really and truly.
I know, run out of time.
Thank you for your call so much.
Thank you for your show.
Well, thank you. Join us Tuesday, 6:30.
I will. Thank you.
All right. Eric, I mean, I just say thank you, you know, for that call from Randall. I mean, that was well stated. I think kind of shows the quality of listener out there. And I appreciate everyone who's called in tonight. Eric, we didn't have time to get to one of the things that I really wanted to discuss, and that was the release last week of the study on prosecutorial misconduct across America.
Right.
And I'm hoping that maybe you could touch on it briefly, and maybe we can bring you back here real soon. But you want to address that?
The Center for Public Integrity, which is one of the most effective, although not one of the best known watchdog groups here in Washington, commissioned an in-depth study of prosecutorial misconduct. They looked at thousands of cases where they found that prosecutors' offices disregarded the
evidence that might show the innocence, that they over-relied upon informants, even knowing the informants were unreliable. They put on laboratory tests where they knew the labs were substandard or where there were reasons to question the credibility or competence of the laboratory personnel. There were just numerous instances that they found, literally thousands of cases. And I think that this is in part because the culture of the war on drugs from the prosecutorial side is a crusade, that they are on a mission and they are quite prepared to dispense with the niceties of the law because this is a crusade. We know that those are the drug users are scum, they're dopers. They've got to be locked up for their own good.
Better off dead.
And for the protection of society. And therefore, they have compromised their own oath to administer justice impartially and to follow the rules of the law. And then what happens is their excesses then get upheld by the courts. They either get ignored by the trial courts or get upheld as harmless error by the Supreme Court. And are then held as sort of not constitutional violations. And the constitutional protections then get further weakened because of those practices.
Eric, we've got about 20 seconds left. Tell the folks about your website and any closing comments you might have.
We always welcome your listeners to www.cjpf.org, the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. Is a 501c3. It depends upon the contributions from the public. And this is work that we are pleased to be doing. We are optimistic that we're going to end the war on drugs and that we will have a safe and healthier society when we regulate and control drugs instead of using prohibition, which strengthens the hands of criminals.
Eric, thank you so much. I want to thank the listeners. I want to remind y'all, please, because of prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please, be careful. Steve Nolan and the whole Cultural Baggage crew, this is Dean Becker, wishing you a safe and happy 4th of July and hoping that the future allows us reason to celebrate many more years of American independence and liberty.